If you were going to set out to design a language that was as different from English as possible, you would probably come up with something like Gwich'in.
The tough job of translating election materials into Gwich'in. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Seth Kantner talks about research for his new children's book, which includes a young porcupine character.
A year ago, there weren't any caribou around up the river there where I was, and so I was eating porcupine. I probably shouldn't say that.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, with health plans designed specifically for Alaska businesses. Learn more at primera.com/newalaska, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development toured parts of Anchorage today. While in town, Julian Castro made an important announcement. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
HUD Secretary Julian Castro announced today the award of millions of dollars in housing grants to American Indian and Alaska Native tribes nationwide. Castro made the announcement while in Anchorage.
I'm pleased to announce that HUD is awarding $60 million in Indian Community Development Block grants to more than 90 tribal communities throughout the nation. These grants are intended to improve housing conditions and stimulate community development, and they also support self-determination. Our tribal partners, not Washington, decide which activities and projects meet their needs.
Castro says he chose to make the announcement in Alaska because of the excellence of the partnerships among state and local governments and nonprofits here that create opportunity for housing and economic development. Castro says local nonprofits, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and other housing entities are able to successfully leverage federal funding with other types of funding to get projects done. Alaska Native tribes will receive about $7 million of the Indian Community Block Grant funds to be distributed among 15 tribes throughout the state. One of those, Cook Inlet Tribal Council, will receive $600,000 to purchase two properties for senior housing. Gloria O'Neill is CEO of Cook Inlet Tribal Council. She says CITC and Cook Inlet Housing Authority work together on housing issues.
I hope this demonstrates how we leverage both of our missions so that we can make investment in the community. And this is the only way that we're able to take the might of what we do and do well and really expand opportunities, especially in this area. We know housing is probably our greatest challenge to overcome in Anchorage, and CITC is just so very grateful that we could play a small piece in it all.
CITC plans a project to house 23 senior citizens, including retail space on the lower level. The HUD grant funds can be used in a variety of ways, including land purchase, rehabilitation of older homes or construction of new ones, even on-road construction or water and sewer programs. 10 Alaska tribal entities received $600,000 grants each, and 5 other tribal communities received lesser amounts. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
After a U.S. District Court order, the Alaska Division of Elections has until the end of this week to provide outreach and poll workers in 3 remote regions of the state with election materials and voting information that has been translated from English into either Yupik or Gwich'in. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, Gwich'in translators are finding the process challenging.
Translating Alaska's election materials into Gwich'in is slow going.
The Alaska Departments of Natural Resources and Law have prepared the following statement of costs to the state of Alaska.
Alan Hayton was contracted by the State Division of Elections.
Alaska nang kakchitivite kwa chats a dakwatin e dekhat dekwehencha state of Alaska.
Some of it is very technical language, legal jargon.
But this isn't the first time he and his colleague Marilyn Savage have tried to translate a large body of work into their native language.
But we've translated other materials too, like Shakespeare. Marilyn and I worked last year translating King Lear into Gwich'in.
For Marilyn Savage, this is also personal.
I'm thinking about my uncle in Fort Yukon. He's blind, and so it'll be good for him to hear our language. I think they'll he'll have a sense of pride in our language, and for a lot of us, it'll increase voting. So people will say, oh, did you go to vote? It's in our language now.
Savage plans to use the Gwich'in ballot this November.
Because it's available, and I'm curious to see how it's presented.
And how it's presented is key. Hayden says they have to remain objective, regardless of how they feel about a candidate or a ballot measure.
You can't try to sway voters. You just have to present the material as it is.
You think it's challenging, though, Marilyn?
Oh, yeah, I think it's challenging. And you do think about what this is going to do, you know, for people's lives.
But there's also no direct translation in Gwich'in for words like commerce, marijuana, or terms like Department of Natural Resources. And those words all appear on Alaska's November ballot. Gary Holton is a linguistics professor at UAF's Alaska Native Language Center. He says translating election materials is daunting because culturally, Gwich'in can't describe some of the concepts involved in the process.
If you were going to set out to design a language that was as different from English as possible, you would probably come up with something like Gwich'in.
There are no Latin roots, and Gwich'in vocabulary is vast.
If you're looking for a word that means to go, you may struggle because in Gwich'in, talking about to go, it makes a difference whether you're talking about one person or two people or three people or an animal that's migrating. All of those are different words for to go, that in English we would use the same word for those.
The state's been ordered to translate everything from public service announcements to buttons for poll workers, as well as the four regional election pamphlets. That's more than 600 pages of material. Marilyn Savage says she never expected her native language to be involved in the modern election process.
Because I always thought our languages for, you know, from people from ancient times, and that it was just their day-to-day language for day-to-day living. Now we're in a century that's pretty high-tech.
Every registered voter receives an election pamphlet by mail, but in an email, State Division of Elections Director Gail Finumiai says there's no way to know for sure whether voters read them before they go to the polls. Alan Hayton says that doesn't matter.
I think in the long run, we do need to have everything that, you know, every other voter would have in their language.
According to the Alaska Native Language Center, there are roughly 300 native Gwich'in speakers in the state. It's not clear how many of them plan to vote this November, but if they do, it will be the first time they'll use a ballot written in their native language, and they might discover a few new words. For KUAC News, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding childcare in the capital city just became even more challenging.
The number of parents searching for care is way, way off the charts in Juneau.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The acting top official of the Alaska National Guard fired two high-ranking officers last week, but reversed the action a day later at the direction of Governor Sean Parnell. Brigadier General Mike Bridges on Thursday asked for the resignations of Brigadier General Catherine Jorgensen and Colonel Eddie Grunwald. Parnell spokeswoman Sharon Lehow tells the Alaska Dispatch News that the officers had applied for the same leadership job that Bridges is seeking. She says by email that Parnell wanted to avoid any appearance of impropriety on behalf of Bridges and directed him to rescind the terminations. A federal investigation released September 4th found ethical misconduct in the Guard. Parnell fired its adjutant general and the civilian deputy commissioner. On Thursday, Parnell said three others would be fired. Today, Parnell named a new special assistant for military issues. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Jay Pullins will serve as the governor's liaison on the team handling National Guard reform efforts. The Forest Service awarded a contract last week to log two-thirds of a controversial Southeast Alaska timber sale. Officials say it's the first of several contracts for what's called the Big Thorn Timber Sale. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Prince of Wales Island's Viking Lumber Company beat out four other bidders for the contract. It covers both logging and stewardship, which means the Forest Service sells timber to Viking but reduces its cost in exchange for trail repair, stream restoration, and other work. Tonga's supervisor, Forrest Cole, oversees such sales.
Typically, we put up timber sale contracts and we award them the highest bidder. This being a stewardship contract, it not only has a timber component, but it also has service work that we expect.
The Forest Service won't release the amount Viking will pay, the value of the stewardship work, or the contract itself. Cole says that's because the contract has not yet been signed. Viking, meanwhile, does not respond to interview requests, but Cole shared some details. The contract calls for almost 3,800 acres to be logged between Thorn Bay and Kaufman Cove. About half would be clear-cut, the other half selectively logged, including some thinning.
So they can log and generate credits, do the service work, and it gets covered that way. Or they can do the service work, and then stumpage will be offset to cover that payment.
The contract calls for about 85 miles of new or repaired roads. About 15 miles of that will be removed once logging is done. The full Big Thorn sale includes more than 6,000 acres of old-growth forest, plus around 2,000 acres of second growth. Cole says logging won't start until spring. That's part of a deal cut with environmental groups challenging the entire Big Thorn sale in court.
What we have agreed to is a briefing schedule to try to get a decision out of the district court by April 1. And April 1 is significant because that's the beginning of operating season.
Viking was the winning bidder on last year's version of the Big Thorn sale. Court challenges kept that from happening. The Juneau-based Southeast Alaska Conservation Council is one of the parties suing to block this year's sale. SEAC Communications Director David Hafey says the sale, and those like it, are costing the Forest Service millions of dollars.
So when we're talking about federally subsidizing a 6,100-acre clear cut and exporting half of that overseas to Asia without any local processing, we're very literally talking about a giveaway.
The Alaska Forest Association, a timber industry organization, isn't objecting to a combined contract. But Executive Director Owen Graham says it's too small.
The sale's only two-thirds as big as it was supposed to. It exists.
Graham says Viking could run out of timber before the contract's spring starting date, and that's only if the sale makes it through the courts. He says officials are not making enough of the Tongass available.
We also need to work with the Forest Service to get a continual stream of additional timber so that they have some longevity. They don't have to liquidate that Big Thorn timber sale, you know, quicker than planned.
Tongass officials will soon announce contracts for at least three smaller sales within the Big Thorn area. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The mayor of the city of Fairbanks has chosen a man with extensive law enforcement experience in the South to lead the Fairbanks Police Department. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Mayor John Eberhardt announced his nomination of Randall Aragon as chief Thursday, citing Aragon's long and diverse experience as the key factor.
Been a police chief for 25 years, teaching very big emphasis on community policing. He served on Governor Huckabee's task force studying racial profiling. So it's a combination of things.
Aragon, who currently serves as chief of police in Lamarck, Texas, was chosen over longtime local police officer Lieutenant Eric Jukes following a forum Monday during which members of an interview team, a diverse group of community leaders, and the public asked the two finalists questions.
The interview team unanimously was willing to support Aragon, and the community leaders strongly came out, most of them, for Chief Aragon.
Mayor Eberhardt says Chief Aragon will be charged with improving the relationship between local police and the community.
The experience that Chief Aragon has in terms of community policing, community outreach, transparency, and communication. For example, he mentions he writes very often an article, I think it's called Chief's Corner, in the Galveston newspaper, somewhere there. Those are all very important.
Mayor Eberhardt will ask the city council to concur with his nomination of Aragon at a council meeting Monday night. If approved, Aragon will start in Fairbanks December 1st. The chief's job pays around $108,000 a year. Eberhardt says he'll recommend Aragon consider Lieutenant Jukes for a deputy chief position. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Infant and toddler care facility Spunky Sprouts 2 in Juneau shut down abruptly at the close of business Wednesday after key staff members quit. Its preschool, Spunky Sprouts Learning Center, is closing at the end of the month. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, the child care shortage problem in the capital city is now even worse.
Parents of 55 infants and toddlers have been scrambling to find child care after Spunky Sprouts 2 shut down. Heather Carlton stayed home from work Thursday morning to figure out where her 2-year-old son Theo will now go to daycare. She says she got a call early Wednesday from a Spunky Sprouts employee about the imminent closure.
I was in a state of panic trying to figure out, what am I going to do? How am I going to find somebody to watch him on such short notice? And, you know, there's already very limited options in Juneau anyways.
Carlton also has a 4-year-old named Arlo, who's been going to Spunky Sprouts for a few years. She says she's been very happy with the care.
He was very quickly potty trained, and his reading skills, very satisfied with it, and he's moving along very well. So I'm very sad about having to make any sort of change and possibly disrupt his education.
Carlton found spots at another daycare for both kids, but other parents haven't been as lucky. Spunky Sprouts administrator Shamila Scalf says staff members started quitting in September. She says some worried they wouldn't be paid. Scalf has worked at the center for 3 years and says as long as she's been there, Spunky Sprouts has always had budget issues. Administrators say they received instructions by email from owner Adam Hendren to distribute 3 letters to parents on September 29th about downsizing and a change of facility. According to the letters, 3 programs in 2 buildings were supposed to become 2 programs in 1 building. Instead, the infant and toddler program shut down October 1st when the main administrator quit and other staff members followed. And Scalf says the preschool center is not moving as indicated in the letter. It's closing at the end of the month. But due to lack of staff, she's already turning some children and parents away at the start of each day. Scalf is the only staff member remaining at Spunky Sprouts with a Child Development Associate credential. State regulation says there can be no more than 30 children under her supervision.
I have 37 registered, paying their fee every month, and I have to send home at least 7. Whoever comes in, number 31, I have to say, I'm sorry, I cannot provide care for you because there is nobody else. And it's embarrassing.
Child Care Center Puddle Jumpers Developmental Learning Center closed in August. After both Spunky Sprout centers close, only 6 licensed full-day child care centers are left in Juneau, according to the Association for the Education of Young Children. There are 2 part-day child care centers. Their total capacity is 288 kids. There are 15 licensed in-home childcare providers with capacity for 143 kids.
We have the worst situation in the state for childcare right now.
Joy Lyon is the executive director of the Southeast chapter of AEYC.
The number of parents searching for care is way, way off the charts in Juneau. There was only 1 space for every 5 children that needed care, and now I think that's dropped to 1 space for every 6 children needing care.
She says her office has been flooded with calls, emails, and visits from Spunky Sprouts parents, many in tears.
We do regular updates of all the programs to find out what openings are available, and there are very few openings.
Lyons says there's a group working on starting a childcare program to serve the Spunky Sprouts families, a process that could take anywhere from 1 to 3 months. Every first Tuesday of the month, AEYC hosts a networking opportunity for parents struggling to find childcare. The next event is October 7th. Spunky Sprouts Learning Center's owner, Adam Hendren, did not return calls for comment. His wife, Jennifer, started Spunky Sprouts. According to state records, the first business license for childcare in her name dates back to 2007. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Author Seth Kantner has published his first children's chapter book. Pup and Pokey tells the story of a wolf pup and a young porcupine that strike up an unusual friendship. Kantner chose first-time illustrator Beth Hill to bring the characters to life. Hill worked out of her home in the village of Cockanock on a tight deadline, producing oil paintings that took 2 weeks to dry for each illustration. Kantner says he and Hill both had opportunities to study porcupines in the wild as they were working on the book.
It was fun working together because I had sent her some photos of porcupines and wolves, and which is what the book's about, sort of. And then I guess maybe last fall, a year ago, there weren't any caribou around up the river there where I was, and so I was eating porcupine. I probably shouldn't say that. But meanwhile, Beth was busy camping and trying to have encounters with porcupine just to, you know, learn more about them. And so it was fun, comparing notes on what we were up to in different parts of Alaska and interactions with animals. Mine might not have been so pleasant for the porcupine, but.
Did you have images in your mind as you were creating these of wolves and porcupines that you've either seen or eaten in the past?
Well,
you decided they should look like this.
As far as the story goes, my daughter, when she was maybe two, I pointed down the stairs and said, look at the moose. And she had heard me say, look at the moose, the real moose, many times. But I was, we were playing. And within a second or two, she looked at me and just looked all surprised and said, yeah, I see it. And so she started, imagining. So I spent lots of time telling her made up babble stories. And that's where my children's stories sort of start. As far as porcupine ambling along the trail, yeah, I have a lot of that stuffed in my head because that's what I grew up with. But turning it into, an imaginary story where the porcupine and the wolf talk to each other and everything, that was just playing around a certain extent, telling stories to my daughter.
When you saw the images that Beth had created, what was your reaction? Was it exactly what you'd imagined? Was it way beyond that? What did you think?
Well, for example, one of her images separate from the book were a lady in extra tough boots. I think that's the kind of boots it was. It's a painting, but a woman dragging a net up on the shore. I just thought it was so perfect of the, fishing. And that always sticks in my mind, that work of hers. So when her illustrations came, I'm a super picky person when it comes to my photography and books and writing. And some of them, like the wolf and the porcupine that we used for the cover, I thought was amazing. And then other ones I would write back to her and I would be problematic and say, wait a minute, porcupine doesn't have that color pattern or something. So she's probably ready to quit dealing with me and this, never have to talk to me again when this is over.
Is that true, Beth? Was he difficult to work with?
No, he wasn't difficult at all, although I've heard stories.
The temperamental artist. Did you have an idea, when he would offer critique like that, what did you think? Were you going for realism or sort of the childish, stylized porcupine? What were your thoughts about it?
I guess what I really liked about this story is that it is a real Alaskan story. And it was important to me to have the characters real. And so, in Cockanock, the village that I live in, porcupine is somewhat of a delicacy. So we would catch porcupine, and I'd take them and pose them and show them, you know, and get, you know, I wanted the illustrations to be correct. And I really appreciated Seth's honesty in making sure that that happened, too.
So, Seth, let's talk a little bit about the book itself and just how it came to you to decide to put together a chapter book.
Well, let's see here. Most children's stories are significantly less words than this one. So I was already barking up a tough tree there because publishing houses want, I don't know the number, but I'm going to say 700 to 1,000 words in their children's story, or 50 words. Some of them are really short. So I have way too many words. And then you start bumping into a chapter book where it's more like Hardy Boys or something. Maybe it's got two or three little line drawings, but this is kind of a weird size, I guess. It's got more words, but I really wanted illustrated. And up until near the end of the process, there was no chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. It was just a story with, I want to say, 4,000 words. Somewhere along in the later stage of editing, we decided to put it into chapters. But it still falls into a interesting category because is the kid going to be reading it to themselves? Or most likely, I think this will be a book that parents read to their kids and later the kid starts reading it themselves, I hope.
Seth Kantner's latest book is Pup and Pokey. The children's book is illustrated by Beth Hill. Kantner will be signing books at the Orca Bookstore in Cordova tomorrow, Tuesday evening, and at the Homer Bookstore on October 11th from 1 to 3. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.